Welcome to the Negotiations Ninja podcast, where we develop and deliver the most engaging negotiation content and training in the world. We host negotiation experts, business people, and entrepreneurs, and discuss what works, what doesn't work, and how we can improve our negotiation skills. What's going on, Negotiations Ninja listeners? You've got Mark here, and this is the Negotiations Ninja podcast. Welcome. Our guest this week is Mr. Michael Reddington. He's an interrogations, sales, and negotiation expert. And this week, we talk all about interrogations and listening and the intersection with that sales, negotiation, and obviously procurement as well. You're going to love this interview that I did with Michael Reddington on interrogation. Michael, how are you?
I'm well, sir. How are you?
I'm very well, man. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for the invitation.
Well, we're going to have a lot of fun today because you are all about forensic questions and forensic interviewing. And before we dive too deeply into the subject, because just even the name kind of gets me excited, I want you to explain to the listeners just a bit about who you are and what you do.
Well, thank you. So I'm a executive resource and certified forensic interviewer. I'll keep it super short, but essentially as a certified forensic interviewer, I had a career in investigations where my teammates and I were tasked with having conversations with people who, by and large, had made regrettable decisions and needed somebody who could approach them in a way that would make them feel comfortable telling us the truth about what happened. And as my career in that world expanded, I made two very important realizations. The first was that the very best leaders and the very best interrogators share the same two core characteristics, vision and influence. And the second is, and this might be more surprising, is the cognitive process that interrogation suspects experience as they truthfully commit to saying, "I did it," is essentially identical to the cognitive processes that employees experience when they commit to saying, "I'll do it," and customers experience when they commit to saying, "I'll buy it." So with those realizations in mind, I took the leash off my inner geek, dove into research from across the spectrum of business communication, integrated the highlights of what I found with the world's leading non-confrontational interview and interrogation techniques, and I created the disciplined listening method. After that, I started Inquasive, and as you started to mention earlier, now I focus on teaching mainly CEOs, executives, sales professionals, HR professionals, and beyond how to apply strategic, ethical observation and persuasion techniques in all of their conversations.
And the word interrogation, I feel like, comes with a lot of baggage, right? When we think about that word, just because of maybe how it's been used in the media, how do you reconcile that when you talk to someone about what you do? And is there a connection between, is that why you use the term forensic interviewer versus interrogation? Is that why there's baggage there?
Certified forensic interviewer is a designation. So like an accountant might achieve a CPA, or a human resources professional might attain their SPHR, or a project management professional gets their designation, CFE, certified fraud examiner. So certified forensic interviewer is, to my knowledge, the designation certification that proves the highest level of expertise and mastery in the field of interview and interrogation. So that in and of itself is a very specific designation. Now, to get back to your question about interrogation and the baggage that comes with that term, man, nail hit squarely on head. There are times when I use that term and it spikes interest from people, curiosity. Oh, cool. Tell me more. And there's others where you would think I just splashed them in the face with a bucket of ice water. Like, just, I don't know what that is. I want to stay completely away from it. So really, for me, when it comes to having conversations about what my investigative career entailed and how that applies to business, it's really important for me early on to use analogies and help cross the bridge so they understand where the connections are. When it comes to actually using those techniques, whether it is in a literal investigative interview or interrogation, or in these business contexts as well, it's really important that we communicate with the way, I mean, bottom line is people are going to perceive how we communicate with them as proof for how much we respect them. So in any conversation, like, do we want to pick a fight or not? And generally, picking a fight at the start of a conversation is just a bad idea. That's even more so if we're in a position where we need to get information from somebody and they have it. Like, probably in contrary to what we would like to believe, if we need information and somebody else has it, we're not in control of this conversation, they are. because they're going to choose when to share it, how much to share, and why to share. So really keeping that in mind as we choose our approach becomes very important.
I like what you said at the beginning, where you said whether it's to get someone to admit that they've done something wrong, or to get employees to say, I'll do something, or to get customers to say, I'll buy something. Is that the ultimate goal of what you're trying to achieve?
Yes. In the investigative sense, as my role as a certified forensic interviewer and all of my peers, our job is to get the truth, whatever that truth may be. It is not to get a confession or an admission, because there's reams of research done on how biases come into play and false confessions can be attended and all those things. So our goal is to get the truth. Now, in order to get the truth, we have to inspire a sense of commitment in somebody to share that truth. If we use techniques where somebody finally says, okay, whatever, I'll just tell you. Maybe it's true, maybe it's not, maybe it's partially true, maybe they'll write it down, maybe they won't, maybe they'll renege and change their story as soon as they walk out of the room. So really what we want to do is communicate with them in a way where they can protect their self-image, save face, and have some idea ownership and really commit to sharing the truth with us. So to circle that back to the question that you asked, yes, whether we are engaged in negotiations, whether it is a sales, especially across a longer, more in-depth sales cycle, whether we're leading, coaching, mentoring, trying to figure out what happened or navigating conflict, we don't want compliance. Compliance is temporary, typically comes with resentment. It feels like a short-term tactical win now, but it's probably going to cause long-term strategic problems down the road. So really, again, as we continue to look at the analogies across the spectrum, it's about creating commitment over compliance and allowing people to protect their self-image and take idea ownership for not just the final decisions, but the series of decisions that lead up to that.
Very cool. So when we're thinking of the forensic interview process and how it ties in potentially into the sales process or the negotiation process within the sales process, where do we see that starting to fit in?
Before the conversation even starts, all the way through till after it's completed. So really, when people have a conversation with me and, oh, well, interview and interrogation, sales and negotiation, it must be all about asking questions, reading behavior, maybe persuasion. Those things are all in there, but each one of those skills or series of techniques are relatively useless on their own. There's a big spider web of techniques that really have to be used together. So that starts with preparation. The same techniques that I would use to prepare for interviews and interrogations, especially in the last role that I had, are the exact same techniques that I use to prepare for these business conversations. Then from a communication standpoint, some of the key phrases that I've always lived by: illustrate before you investigate. Remember, questions can be perceived as invitations or attacks. Taking that strategic long view, the same persuasive elements, of course, helping people protect their self-image. So from that strategic preparation to the real astute, situationally aware observation, to being able to move people from resistance to commitment, ask great questions, and even follow up after. Because the only way to prove to somebody we really listened or we really care is to follow up after the interaction has concluded. So really across the spectrum, the same approaches line up quite well.
Something that you said there struck my interest. And I think it's really important for people to understand. You said resistance to commitment, and you're talking about sort of the persuasion cycle, I would assume, when you're saying that. So I think what a lot of people get wrong is they try and jump from resistance straight to commitment instead of thinking about the in-between steps. That I see as a big mistake in a lot of negotiations that happen. What are some ways that you could potentially help people to think about that differently, and why it's so important potentially to move from step to step? Or maybe it's not. Maybe tell us why it's not.
I'm in lockstep with you. So I would agree that generally, now as I equivocate, right? But generally going step to step is important. Now we might find ourselves in a scenario where all of a sudden we can skip five. But, and this ties back to my interrogation roots as well. Generally speaking, we're far better off going through the steps, getting to the end and realizing, no, maybe I didn't need all of those. Then we are thinking, well, I'm not going to go through the steps. And then bam, setting off a landmine and going, oh, now I got to go back and do them. Well, now we have to go back and do them against higher levels of resistance. People who've already taken a position, it's going to be much more difficult. Generally, we're far better off preparing for and assuming that we're going to execute these steps and then adapting if there's an obvious reason to.
Yeah, totally agree. One of the problems that I've seen with, at least on the relationship between enterprise sales and enterprise procurement people, is that the salespeople's job is to get information from the procurement people about when does a decision need to be made, when does a solution need to be in place, how much are you willing to spend on this, all of that kind of stuff. And there's a certain amount of information that the procurement people cannot share, or sometimes evade sharing. And there's like this evasive, like cat and mouse dance that happens a lot of the time. What kind of questions would you ask, or how would you approach the situation where someone is being evasive with you?
Let's take it back to the approach, and then we'll get to the questions if we have a couple of minutes. Love what you said. So for me, there's a couple of things there that I love to touch on. First, one of the things that makes my skin crawl is sort of the old accepted, I don't know, the wisdom is the right word, phrase that buyers are liars, I think is how people like to say. Not true. Not any more or less than you or I or anybody else. We all have goals, and we all are going to, when we have the time to think about it, strategically share information that's more likely to help us achieve those goals. Like, that's not dishonesty. That's interest protection, like you said prior. It's how the game is played. So really what we do is, prior to any interaction, like you said, in this specific example, where we need information that other people will likely be motivated to withhold, it starts before we ever enter the room. So for me, as I prepare to enter that conversation, I don't sit there and think to myself, well, why should Mark share this information with me? Because quite frankly, you shouldn't. Instead, I ask myself the opposite. Why shouldn't Mark share this information with me from his perspective? And then, because I'm a bit of a caveman, I literally will write all of those down on a piece of paper, usually down the left-hand margin. Then I will look at that list and I'll ask myself, how can I build a strategy based on my perceived weaknesses and threats as opposed to my perceived strengths? So I'm going to look at all of these reasons why I think, from your perspective, you might not want to give me this information. And now I'm going to build my communication strategy from what I illustrate, from the questions I ask, to the order I do it. It might even be like the day and time of the conversation, the modality. How do we connect? And especially when we talk about enterprise sales, there is almost certainly going to be an iterative sales process. It might take weeks, it might take months, it might take years, depending on the organization. So now, and you talk about trying to jump to commitment right away, I might not even be thinking jump to get this information in the first call. Like, over the course of the sales cycle, where do I really need it? And from a selfish standpoint, I don't want to go into this like, time is the enemy of empathy. Time is the enemy of listening. Time is the enemy of strategic preparation and communication. If I go into this conversation with Mark and I think, well, okay, I need to figure out where he is in my funnel as fast as possible and how much time he's really worth or not. Well, this isn't about you anymore. It's about me. And I'm almost certainly going to communicate now in a way that encourages you to withhold information as opposed to share it, because I'll clearly come off with, I'm trying to figure out if you're valuable for me, as opposed to understanding where the real value is. So strategically, I want to lay that out. I joke, but it is true as well. People from the United States are all mostly, I think, familiar with Miranda, and people that aren't from the United States but have seen at least one police movie or TV show are familiar with it. When someone gets arrested, the officer says, you have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be held against you in a court of law. We like to say that our customers have been Mirandized as well, because a lifetime of buying has taught them that anything they say can and will be used against them at our very first opportunity. So if we don't keep that experience in mind, and if we don't raise our situational awareness, then it's going to be very difficult for us to authentically lead them to that commitment to share that information with us.
Hey, listeners, I want to tell you about another company that I run called Content Callout. It is a thought leadership brand marketing company. Now, what does that mean? It means that we take you as an executive or entrepreneur, a leader of a small or medium-sized business, and we turn you into a thought leader online. We take your personal brand and we amp it up to 11. So that you can lead with confidence, knowing that people will recognize you, recognize your brand, and recognize your business because of the thought leadership approach that you've taken on social media through content creation and content distribution, as well as engaging with all of your following online. How do you get involved in this? Easy, easy, easy. Just go to contentcallout.com/get started And you will see there three different options that will allow you to take your thought leadership brand for yourself and for your business to the next level. We are super excited to talk to you about this. We've seen some massive growth with the businesses that we've been working with. Very, very exciting time for us. Look at that. We appreciate it. Now back to your show. You touched on a few things that I really love in terms of the preparation, right? Planning your ideas around why shouldn't I share this or why shouldn't the counterparty share this information with me and planning how I approach that and then thinking about where should I be able to access that in the sales cycle. And there's this constant, and all I can think of is like for the salespeople that are under pressure to perform on a quarterly basis, right? They're getting hammered by their leaders saying, hey, what are the numbers? What are the numbers? What are the numbers? And so there's this constant tension between like working the deal properly, which is what you're talking about, versus like trying to push it and keep it going. Is there a way to marry those two? Or do you feel like there's going to be a constant tension between those two things?
There may always be a constant tension between those two things. Like, and the leaders are going to be numbers driven, rightfully so. I mean, those numbers are going to turn right into business growth and shareholder value and potentially their bonus and evaluation and all those things. So we get that. Now, what we want to try to do is take a step back and like anybody who's ever competed in anything, how much of that competition was decided before anybody took the field or the court or hit the mat or whatever it was based on their preparation. So if we are at an end of a month or a quarter or wherever we are, a year, a season, and our leader is getting on to us about where are our numbers, where are we with these? Well, at this point, the horse is so far out of the barn that if we're now sending emails and picking up phones and knocking on doors and trying to close these real quick, what we're doing is we're likely resorting to suboptimal time-driven approaches to try to make up for gaps in our previous activity. Now, that's not always true because sometimes things like, oh, well, a pandemic happened that are entirely out of our control. So I certainly don't want to paint that as an everyday situation. So part of it really gets back to that strategic approach of one, understanding the difference between lag measures and lead measures. Like the numbers are a lag measure. The lead measure is all the things we're doing to drive the numbers. So really focusing on that sales cycle, when we work with our clients, one of the things that we'll literally do is we'll get a whiteboard and we'll diagram what the sales cycle looks like. It's for most organizations, most of their sales generally follow the same arc the majority of the time within a reasonable level of tolerance. And to that degree, they run into the same problems relatively the same time, the same issues, the same opportunity, the same challenges. So if the sales cycle is relatively predictable to a reasonable degree, and we say, well, generally around the fourth conversation is when we run into this problem. And we just run into that problem again. How are we allowing ourselves to do that? Like if we were driving down the street and there was a brick wall in front of us, but we say, oh, that looks like a brick wall and just drive right into it. At some point, we would probably try to go around it before making impact. So I don't know if I've answered your question directly, and I'm happy to come back to it. But really looking at the approach we're using to put us into that situation and adjusting it over the long term.
Yeah. And I think you did answer the question. I think one of the questions that will naturally pop up as a result of this is someone will reach out to me and be like, okay, I get it. That's all really great. But I still need the buyer to be able to make a decision faster than they usually would. So how do I increase the speed at which that buying decision gets made? And it, a lot of the time, that question results in a conversation around, is this a priority, right? Like, is this a priority for the person that could be potentially buying my stuff? And so maybe I'll ask you, are there questions that we could ask that would elicit more of a response based on a priority that we set in the person's mind?
The answer is yes. Some of those are going to be more contextually specific. So I'll do a few examples. One thing that I would love to add, and I kind of hinted at this earlier, is that oftentimes not only is the question important, but how we set the question up can be more important than the question that we ask, especially as the stress gets dialed up on us within the sales process.
Right.
We can resort to just asking more questions and asking them faster, like just back to back, which can start to put people on the defensive. So one of the
makes you look like the Spanish Inquisition as well, right? Like,
yes.
Yeah. Like it just makes you look terrible.
100%. So especially in enterprise sales, people are looking to us for our expertise, for our guidance, for our leadership, for our ability to teach them, enhance their perspective, their knowledge. It's very hard to come off as an expert if we're just asking questions. in order to really come off as an expert, we have to be able to illustrate that expertise effectively throughout the conversation. And so that's why we get back to illustrate before we investigate. And there's some even tricks within that. And when we talk about persuasion, I default back to Robert Cialdini's work, and anybody that hasn't read his work should probably bump that to the top of their list ASAP if they're interested in influence and persuasion. But you look at his 7 automatic mechanisms of persuasion. There are little things we can do to invoke 3 or 4 of them anyway, all at the same time as we illustrate before we investigate. So if we are trying to figure out where somebody is with their priorities, I don't want to just say, well, Mark, I'm sure you're probably busy and you have a lot of things going on right now. So where does this fall within your priorities?
Right.
Because number one, you feel a bit attacked with that question because it's used the words you and your like 4 times in 10 seconds. But that also, to your previous point, gets back to, okay, I'm going to give you what is in my best interest in order to keep you where I want you to be throughout the remainder of our interaction. Whereas if I now switch it to say, Mark, our experience has taught us that throughout this process, which typically takes months in order for us to go through to the degree that we need in order to arrive at the pinpoint solutions necessary to partner together, we know that things are going to change on both sides, whether it is pressure from our leadership, pressure from our customers, whether it's different budgeting pressures. Sometimes the board may even get involved depending on where we're at. And as these pressures change, now our focus changes. What I like to try to do anytime I can is just to pause to get an idea on things that I can do in order to make it as easy as possible and really as stress-free for our partners to begin to manage this process within their existing competing priorities.
Mm.
So, Mark, with that, and now I've set up the question.
Right.
And I've set it up by illustrating it in the third person. I've been here. I've done that. I know this. So my credibility perception increases. I'm not saying the word you, so you don't feel attacked or defensive. And now it's easier for you to share information with me. Now I can come back and ask any number of potential questions that might include, as you try to forecast your schedule over the next 6 months, where do you typically see the best opportunities for us to follow up? Or as you try to forecast your schedule over the next 6 months, what is the order of information that would be most helpful to you? One that I used recently that was quite successful was instead of saying to somebody the old, well, who else is involved in this decision-making process and how long do they need to make their decision? Yeah, which just makes the person you're talking to feel useless. Like, thank you, stepping stone. Who can I get to next? Instead, we go with, again, and there's a couple of different ways to do it, but off the top of my head, our experience with this process knows that no matter how intimately we are involved with the process, other people are going to want to get their hands on it. That's just the world that we live in.
Right.
So as I attempt to make this as seamless a process as I possibly can, generally what I like to do is provide people with the answers to the questions they know they're going to get before they get them, so I can help reduce their stress in the inevitable follow-up conversations. So if you had to say, what do you think are the top 3 or 4 questions that you'll probably get asked by somebody who feels the need to insert themselves in this situation?
I love that. And I love it because you're establishing authority by that question setup as well, right? Which is one of the big components of what Cialdini talks about. Without that authority, it becomes very challenging to persuade or influence anyone to any substantive measure. Are there other tools within sort of the persuasion list of that Cialdini is most famous for that you use as sort of like your go-to?
That illustrate before we investigate one is enormous. I mean, that is bread and butter for me across all contexts. That's bread and butter for me. When I'm buying a car or negotiating on a loan for work on our house, I can literally see my wife rolling her eyes sometimes as I use these techniques in all of those conversations. So illustrate before you investigate is one. Another one that we just touched on was really limiting how often I say you. I don't think people realize how potentially offensive the word you can be.
It's very accusatory.
Super accusatory. And we accidentally accuse people all the time. Have you done this yet? Did you read this? You're basically accusing me of not doing it. And that, I'm sure it's not what the person asking the question means. But as soon as we get back on the phone with somebody after we've sent them a proposal or a document or schematics or whatever it might be, did you take the time to read it? That comes off as an accusation right away. But instead, if we use the exact same techniques we just worked on in the previous example, drop the word you, illustrate before we investigate. Now we say, I've got to remember that when we send these schematics off to folks, that they've got about 9,487 other things going on. So with that said, has there been an opportunity for you to even take a quick glance at them just so I know where to start?
I really like that. One of the things that people struggle with in negotiation, especially when it comes to like sales and procurement, is the whole idea that there needs to be trust in the conversation. And I think there's an argument that comes up, and this comes up a lot, is it trust or is it rapport that we're trying to build, or is it both? I'd love to hear your thoughts on the sort of the need for trust or the need for rapport in negotiations at that sort of scale.
I love it. And one man's opinion, they're similar yet different. Oftentimes, trust is going to hedge or is going to be heavily reliant on rapport. Mm-hmm. The more we can build authentic rapport, the more we can increase our trust level. Now, that's not always entirely true, because if I got a recommendation to you from somebody who I implicitly trust, then I'm probably going to trust you off the bat. Like, you might be able to ruin that if you tried hard enough, but I'm going to probably trust you off the bat. Or if I did my research and I truly believe that you are the top of the food chain in your world, then I might have some initial trust there that rapport can certainly help build. So one certainly can't exist without the other. But one of the biggest mistakes that comes straight from the interrogation room that I see in business as well is the harder we try to build rapport with somebody, the more it negatively impacts our trust.
Interesting. Like,
the more somebody feels like you're trying to be my friend, you're trying too hard to demonstrate right. similarity, you're too needy. Now, it starts setting off these bells and whistles. Like, wait a minute, why are you trying so hard to be my friend? Why are you trying so hard to say that we're the same? I had a Zoom call with somebody very early on in the pandemic. And sure enough, in their background, I can see all of the local sports paraphernalia behind them. I'm your average American dude. I watch a fair amount of sports. I could talk about probably everybody in those posters. But that's the temptation for a lot of people. Hey, I see you're a this fan. Hey, I see you're a that fan. And as soon as we do that at the top of the conversation, people know where we're going with. Oh, congratulations. You're trying to build rapport and make us friends. Let's slow your roll. So for me, I will literally wait till later on in the conversation, and I'll work in an illustration. So that gentleman happened to be based in Kansas City. And for anybody that's from or been to or going to Kansas City, Arthur Bryan is my personal favorite barbecue place in Kansas City, which has great barbecue all over the city. So as we were talking, he asked a question that led me to a conversation that I literally had at Arthur Bryant's. I was training somebody. We were talking about business development. It happened at Arthur Bryant's. So I told the story. And instead of just telling it as I talked to a guy, I said, yeah, actually, as a matter of fact, it was probably 3 years ago, I was eating ribs in the back of Arthur Bryant's. Now, because I make the statement 20 minutes into the conversation,
gotcha.
We have something in common, as opposed to me just dumping on them all my favorite things about Kansas City in the beginning. So how it's we
way more strategic.
Forward. Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah, I really like that. And I find that a big issue that I see is I think what you're talking about is the relation also to storytelling. There's a big problem that I see with a lot of sales and procurement people where they can't weave stories into their conversation. And so often there's the argument of be more interested than interesting, but you also still have to be interesting, right? Like there still has to be something compelling about you for me to want to interact with you. And there's a component of storytelling there that I think a lot of people really miss out on. Do you feel like that there's a storytelling component inside of the forensic interview process?
100%. In fact, in a lot of ways, it is the vehicle that helps people make the determination to tell us the truth. To drastically oversimplify, my personal favorite, and in my opinion, the most adaptable, successful, non-confrontational interrogation technique. Basically, we start by building rapport. Then after we build rapport, which by the way, in that environment is about 2 minutes or less the vast majority of the time. Because anything more than that, people start to get suspicious. Why are you trying to be my friend? So we're going to build rapport first. Then we're going to establish credibility in ourselves and our investigation. Then we're going to go through a storytelling process that helps people save face and protect their self-image. Essentially, help them analogize that they're not bad people. They just made regrettable decisions. People make regrettable decisions all the time. We're not saying it's legal or right. Then after that helps them protect their self-image and begin to essentially say to themselves, okay, now I feel more comfortable telling Mike this because I can use these reasons, or I can put my spin on it. I can use these frameworks. Then we get into the strategic questioning process. And the same, in a lot of ways, really works in enterprise sales and procurement as well. So, and it's oftentimes, it's not 4 score and 7 years ago, like get a cup of coffee and get comfortable. But just sometimes it can be three or four sentences, just little narrations, little examples, because to your point about authority earlier, not only do sharing the stories to get back to Cialdini, just off the top, you're talking authority and social proof in spades, because if I tell a story that is involves a similar experience that somebody had who you see yourself similar to, now we've got social proof. Then there's the perception of authority again, because it's not my first rodeo. I've been here. I can share this. Now, reciprocation can start to kick in depending on how I tell the story. Liking can start to kick in depending on how I like the story. And most importantly, consistency can kick in. Because if when people make decisions, if we want somebody to think, say, or do something that wasn't their idea, at least three quarters, if not 80 to 85% of that battle is helping them line up that decision with their self-image.
Talk about that just briefly, if you could. What do you mean by lining up that with their self-image?
So if we're talking interrogation, they've got to see it as okay for themselves, who they see themselves as. They've got to see it okay for themselves to confess, or often for me, more to not use the best word, entertaining, to snitch. Two of my all-time favorite interrogations. I got one guy who was a certified hard dude to snitch on his brother. I got another guy who was essentially in hot water for bullying somebody else and accusing them of being a snitch to snitch on the people he was bullying with. So in these situations, those aren't like world-beating cases by any stretch. But when you think about what it takes to get somebody who is a card-carrying, hill-defending, flag-waving anti-snitch, to get them to snitch, like you've got to line that up with their self-image. So now we take that to buying. I've got to line up somebody's decision not only to purchase this product or service, but purchase it in a manner from me in a way that is consistent with their self-image. And when we think about stress and pressure, oftentimes under stress, we go to what we know. The joke I like to make is I train jiu-jitsu and I could spend all night working on new techniques, slap hands and start sparring with somebody that outweighs me by 80 pounds. And all of a sudden, those new techniques I know are gone. Like, I cannot remember them. And I'm going back to what I've always been comfortable with. In sales, unfortunately, we are most comfortable with our stuff, our product, our service, who we are, how proud of ourselves and our organization we are. So when that pressure starts to grind, we default to talking or bragging about ourselves, which then throws a wrench in the process and begins to deconstruct all of these important things that you've been mentioning.
Fascinating. Really fascinating. I love this conversation, man. We definitely need to do a round two. But before then, people need to know how to reach out to you. So where can people find you online?
I appreciate you asking. They can find loads of our content and a lot more about our education and advisory services at inquasive.com, inquasive.com. And they can find me on LinkedIn at Michael Reddington, CFI.
Amazing, man. This has been a really cool conversation. I appreciate you being here today. I appreciate you sharing your wisdom. So thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for your time and the invitation. I've loved the conversation. And if you have me back, I'll be here.
Hey, friends, thanks so much for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed it, please share it with friends and colleagues so that they can benefit from it as well. If you find Negotiations Ninja Podcast worthy, please go on to iTunes and give us a cool rating with a nice review. We certainly appreciate every single one that we get because it helps us to understand who is listening, how they're listening, and what it is they like. If there's something that you would like me to discuss around negotiation, influence, or persuasion, give me a shout. You know how to reach me on social media, or you can get me on my website, which is www.negotiations.ninja.